This is Audible.
Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Nine Perfect Strangers, written by Leanne Moriarty and read by Caroline Lee. The dedication reads, "For Katie and for Dad, with lots of love from me." You suppose you are the trouble, but you are the cure. You suppose that you are the lock on the door, but you are the key that opens it. Rumi. Just when I discovered the meaning of life, they changed it. George Carlin. Chapter 1. Yao.
"I'm fine," said the woman. "There is nothing wrong with me."
She didn't look fine to Yao. It was his first day as a trainee paramedic, his third call-out. Yao wasn't nervous, but he was in a hyper-vigilant state because he couldn't bear to make even an inconsequential mistake. When he was a child, mistakes had made him wail inconsolably, and they still made his stomach cramp. A single bead of perspiration rolled down the woman's face, leaving a snail's trail through her makeup. Yao wondered why women painted their faces orange, but that was not relevant.
"I'm fine. Maybe just the 24-hour virus," she said, with a hint of an Eastern European accent.
"Observe everything about your patient and their environment," Yao's supervisor, Finn, had told him. "Think of yourself as a secret agent looking for diagnostic clues." Yao observed a middle-aged, overweight woman with pronounced pink shadows under distinctive sea-green eyes and wispy brown hair pulled into a sad little knot at the back of her neck. She was pale and clammy, her breathing ragged. A heavy smoker, judging by her ashtray scent. She sat in a high-backed leather chair behind a gigantic desk. It seemed like she was something of a bigwig, if the size of this plush corner office and its floor-to-ceiling harbor views were any indication of corporate status. They were on the 17th floor, and the sails of the opera house were so close you could see the diamond-shaped cream and white tiles. The woman had one hand on her mouse. She scrolled through emails on her oversized computer screen as if the two paramedics checking her over were a minor inconvenience. Repairmen there to fix a PowerPoint. She wore a tailored navy business suit, like a punishment, the jacket pulled uncomfortably tight across her shoulders. Yao took the woman's free hand and clipped a pulse oximeter onto her finger. He noted a shiny, scaly patch of reddish skin on her forearm. Pre-diabetic? Finn asked,
"Are you on any medication, Marsha?"
He had a chatty, loose manner with patients, as if he were making small talk at a barbecue, beer in hand. Yao noticed that Finn always used the names of patients, whereas Yao felt shy talking to them as though they were old friends. But if it enhanced patient outcomes, he would learn to overcome his shyness.
"I am on no medication at all," said Marsha,
her gaze fixed on the computer. She clicked on something decisively, then looked away from her monitor and back up at Finn. Her eyes looked like they'd been borrowed from someone beautiful. Yao assumed they were colored contact lenses.
I am in good health. I apologize for taking up your time.
I certainly didn't ask for an ambulance.
I called the ambulance,
said a very pretty, dark-haired young woman in high heels and a tight-checked skirt with interlocking diamond shapes similar to the opera house tiles. The skirt looked excellent on her, but that was obviously of no relevance right now, even though she was technically part of the surrounding environment Yao was meant to be observing. The girl chewed on the fingernail of her little finger.
I'm her PA.
She lowered her voice as if she were about to reveal something shameful. Her face went dead white, and then she fell off her chair.
I did not fall off my chair, snapped Marcia.
She kind of slid off it, amended the girl.
I momentarily felt dizzy. That is all, said Marcia to Finn. And then I got straight back to work. Could we cut this short? I'm happy to pay your full, you know, cost or rate or however it is you charge for your services. I have private health cover, of course. I just really don't have time for this right now.
She turned her attention back to her assistant.
Don't I have an 11 o'clock with Ryan?
I'll cancel him.
Did I hear my name?
Said a man from the doorway.
What's going on?
A guy in a too tight purple shirt swaggered in, carrying a bundle of manila folders. He spoke with a plummy British accent, like he was a member of the royal family.
Nothing, said Marcia. Take a seat.
Marcia is clearly not available right now, said the poor PA. Yao sympathized. He didn't appreciate flippancy about matters of health, and he thought his profession deserved more respect. He also had a strong aversion to spiky-haired guys with posh accents who wore purple shirts a size too small to show off their overly developed pecs.
No, no. Just sit down, Ryan. This won't take long. I'm fine.
Marcia beckoned impatiently. Can I check your blood pressure, please? Marcia, said Yao, bravely mumbling her name as he went to strap the cuff around her upper arm.
Let's take that jacket off first.
Finn sounded amused. You're a busy lady, Marcia.
I actually really do need her sign-off on these, said the young guy to the PA in a low voice.
Yao thought, I actually really do need to check your boss's vital signs right now, motherfucker. Finn helped Marcia out of her jacket and put it over the back of her chair in a courtly way.
Let's see those documents, Ryan.
Marcia adjusted the buttons on her cream silk shirt.
I just need signatures on the top two pages.
The guy held out the folder.
Are you kidding me?
The PA lifted both hands incredulously. Mate, you need to come back another time, said Finn, with a definite edge to his barbecue voice. The guy stepped back, but Marcia clicked her fingers at him for the folder, and he instantly jumped forward and handed it over. He obviously considered Marcia scarier than Finn, which was saying something. because Finn was a big, strong guy. This will take 14 seconds at the most, she said to Finn. Her voice thickened on the word most, so that it sounded like most. Yao, the blood pressure cuff still in his hand, made eye contact with Finn. Marsha's head lolled to one side, as though she'd just nodded off. The manila folder slipped from her fingers. Marsha? Finn spoke in a loud, commanding voice. She slumped forward, arms akimbo, like a puppet. Just like that, screeched the PA with satisfaction. That's exactly what she did before. Jesus! The purple shirt guy retreated. Jesus! Sorry, I'll just...
Okay, Marsha, let's get you onto the floor, said Finn.
Finn lifted her under the armpits and Yao took her legs, grunting with the effort. She was a very tall woman, Yao realized, much taller than him. At least 6 feet, and a dead weight. Together, he and Finn laid her on her side on the grey carpet. Finn folded her jacket into a pillow and put it behind her head. Marsha's left arm rose stiff and zombie-like above her head. Her hands curled into spastic fists. She continued to breathe in jerky gasps as her body postured. She was having a seizure. Seizures were disquieting to watch, but Yao knew you just had to wait them out. There was nothing around Marsha's neck that Yao could loosen. He scanned the space around her and saw nowhere she could bang her head.
Is this what happened earlier?
Finn looked up at the assistant.
No. No, before she just sort of fainted.
The wide-eyed PA watched with appalled fascination.
Does she have a history of seizures?
Asked Finn.
I don't think so. I don't know.
As she spoke, the PA was shuffling back towards the door of the office, where a crowd of other corporate types had now gathered. Someone held up a mobile phone, filming, as if their boss's seizure were a rock concert.
Start compressions.
Finn's eyes were flat and smooth like stones. There was a moment, no more than a second, but still a moment in which Yao did nothing as his brain scrambled to process what had just happened. He would remember that moment of frozen incomprehension forever. He knew that a cardiac arrest could present with seizure-like symptoms, and yet he'd still missed it because his brain had been so utterly, erroneously convinced of one reality. This patient is having a seizure. If Finn hadn't been there, Yao may have sat back on his haunches and observed a woman in cardiac arrest without acting. Like an airline pilot flying a jet into the ground because he is overly reliant on his faulty instruments. Yao's finest instrument was his brain, and on this day it was faulty. They shocked her twice, but were unable to establish a consistent heart rhythm. Marsha Dmitrychenko was in full cardiac arrest as they carried her out of the corner office to which she would never return. Chapter 2. 10 years later. Francis. On a hot, cloudless January day, Francis Welty, the formerly best-selling romantic novelist, drove alone through scrubby bushland 6 hours northwest of her Sydney home. The black ribbon of highway unrolled hypnotically ahead of her as the air conditioning vents roared Arctic air full blast at her face. The sky was a giant deep blue dome surrounding her tiny solitary car. There was far too much sky for her liking. She smiled because she reminded herself of one of those peevish TripAdvisor reviewers. So I called reception and asked for a lower, cloudier, more comfortable sky. A woman with a strong foreign accent said there were no other skies available. She was very rude about it, too. Never again. Don't waste your money. It occurred to Frances that she was possibly quite close to losing her mind. No, she wasn't. She was fine, perfectly sane, really and truly. She flexed her hands around the steering wheel, blinked dry eyes behind her sunglasses, and yawned so hugely her jaw clicked. Ow, she said, although it didn't hurt. She sighed, looking out the window for something to break the monotony of the landscape. It would be so harsh and unforgiving out there. She could just imagine it, the drone of blowflies, the mournful cry of crows, and all that glaring white-hot light. Wide brown land, indeed. Come on, give me a cow, a crop, a shed. I spy with my little eye something beginning with N. Nothing. She shifted in her seat, and her lower back rewarded her with a jolt of pain so violent and personal, it brought tears to her eyes. For God's sake, she said pitifully. The back pain had begun 2 weeks ago, on the day she finally accepted that Paul Drabble had disappeared. She was dialing the number for the police and trying to work out how to refer to Paul, her partner, boyfriend, lover, her special friend, when she felt the first twinge. It was the most obvious example of psychosomatic pain ever, except knowing it was psychosomatic didn't make it hurt any less. It was strange to look in the mirror each night and see the reflection of her lower back looking as soft, white, and gently plump as it always had. She expected to see something dreadful, like a gnarled mass of tree roots. She checked the time on the dashboard. 2:57 p.m. The turnoff should be coming up any minute. She'd told the reservations people at Tranquillum House that she'd be there around 3:30 to 4 p.m., and she hadn't made any unscheduled stops. Tranquillum House was a boutique health and wellness resort. Her friend Ellen had suggested it. You need to heal, she'd told Frances after their third cocktail, an excellent white peach Bellini, at lunch last week. You look like shit. Ellen had done a cleanse at Tranquillum House 3 years ago, when she too had been burnt out and run down and out of condition and, yes, yes, I get it, Frances had said. It's quite unusual, this place, Ellen had told Frances. Their approach is kind of unconventional. Life-changing. How exactly did your life change? Frances had asked, reasonably. But she'd never got a clear answer to that question. In the end, it all seemed to come down to the whites of Ellen's eyes, which had become really white, like freakily white. Also, she lost 3 kilos. Although Tranquillum House wasn't about weight loss, Ellen was at great pains to point that out. It was about wellness. But, you know, what woman complains about losing 3 kilos? Not Ellen, that's for sure. Not Frances, either. Frances had gone home and looked up the website. She'd never been a fan of self-denial, never been on a diet, rarely said no if she felt like saying yes, or yes if she felt like saying no. According to her mother, Frances's first greedy word was more. She always wanted more. Yet, the photos of Tranquillum House had filled her with a strange, unexpected yearning. They were golden-hued, all taken at sunset or sunrise, or else filtered to make it look that way. Pleasantly middle-aged people did warrior poses in a garden of white roses next to a beautiful country house. A couple sat in one of the natural hot springs that surrounded the property. Their eyes were closed, heads tipped back, and they were smiling ecstatically as water bubbled around them. Another photo showed a woman enjoying a hot stone massage on a deck chair next to an aquamarine swimming pool. Frances had imagined those hot stones placed with delightful symmetry down her own spine, their magical heat melting away her pain. As she dreamed of hot springs and gentle yoga, a message flashed urgently on her screen. Only one place remaining for the exclusive 10-day mind and body total transformation retreat. It had made her feel stupidly competitive, and she clicked book now, even though she didn't really believe there was only one place remaining. Still, she keyed in her credit card details pretty damned fast, just in case. It seemed that in a mere 10 days, she would be transformed in ways she never thought possible. There would be fasting, meditation, yoga, creative emotional release exercises. There would be no alcohol, sugar, caffeine, gluten, or dairy. But as she'd just had the degustation menu at the Four Seasons, she was stuffed full of alcohol, sugar, caffeine, gluten, and dairy, and the thought of giving them up didn't seem that big a deal. Meals would be personalized to her unique needs. Before her booking was accepted, she had to answer a very long, rather invasive online questionnaire about her relationship status, diet, medical history, alcohol consumption in the previous week, and so on. She cheerfully lied her way through it. It was really none of their business. She even had to upload a photo taken in the last 2 weeks. She sent one of herself from her lunch with Ellen at the Four Seasons, holding up a Bellini. There were boxes to tick for what she hoped to achieve during her 10 days, everything from intensive couples counseling to significant weight loss. Frances ticked only the nice-sounding boxes, like spiritual nourishment. Like so many things in life, it had seemed like an excellent idea at the time. The TripAdvisor reviews for Tranquillum House, which she'd looked at after she'd paid her non-refundable fee, had been noticeably mixed. It was either the best, most incredible experience people had ever had, they wished they could give it more than 5 stars, they were evangelical about the food, the hot springs, the staff, or it was the worst experience of their entire lives. There was talk of legal action, post-traumatic stress, and dire warnings of enter at your own peril. Frances looked again at the dashboard, hoping to catch the clock tick over to 3. Stop it. Focus. Eyes on the road, Frances. You're the one in charge of this car. Something flickered in her peripheral vision, and she flinched, ready for the massive thud of a kangaroo smashing her windscreen. It was nothing. These imaginary wildlife collisions were all in her head, If it happened, it happened. There probably wouldn't be time to react. She remembered a long ago road trip with a boyfriend. They'd come across a dying emu that had been hit by a car in the middle of a highway. Frances had stayed in the passenger seat, a passive princess, while her boyfriend got out and killed the poor emu with a rock. One sharp blow to the head. When he returned to the driver's seat, he was sweaty and exhilarated, a city boy thrilled with his own humane pragmatism. Frances never quite forgave him for the sweaty exhilaration. He'd liked killing the emu. Frances wasn't sure if she could kill a dying animal, even now when she was 52 years old, financially secure, and too old to be a princess. "You could kill the emu," she said out loud. "Certainly you could." Goodness. She'd just remembered that the boyfriend was dead. Wait, was he? Yes, definitely dead. She'd heard it on the grapevine a few years back. Complications from pneumonia, supposedly. Gary always did suffer terribly from colds. Frances had never been especially sympathetic. At that very moment, her nose dripped like a tap. Perfect timing. She held the steering wheel with one hand and wiped her nose with the back of her other hand. Disgusting. It was probably Gary vindictively making her nose drip from the afterlife. Fair enough, too. They'd once been on road trips and professed their love, and now she couldn't even be bothered to remember he was dead. She apologized to Gary, although really, if he was able to access her thoughts, then he should know that it wasn't her fault. If he'd made it to this age, he'd know how extraordinarily vague and forgetful one became. Not all the time. Just sometimes. "Sometimes I'm as sharp as a tack, Gary." She sniffed again. It seemed like she'd had this truly horrendous head cold even longer than the back pain. Hadn't she been sniffling the day she delivered her manuscript? 3 weeks ago? Her 19th novel. She was still waiting to hear what her publisher thought. Once upon a time, back in the late 90s, her heyday, her editor would have sent champagne and flowers within 2 days of delivery, together with a handwritten note. Another masterpiece. She understood she was no longer in her heyday, but she was still a solid mid-level performer. An effusive email would be nice. Or just a friendly one. Even a brisk one-liner. "Sorry, haven't got to it yet, but can't wait." That would have been polite. A fear she refused to acknowledge tried to worm its way up from her subconscious. No, no, absolutely not. She clutched the steering wheel and tried to calm her breathing. She'd been throwing back cold and flu tablets to try to clear her nose, and the pseudoephedrine was making her heart race, as if something wonderful or terrible was about to happen. It reminded her of the feeling of walking down the aisle on both her wedding days. She was probably addicted to the cold and flu tablets. She was easily addicted. Men, food, wine. In fact, she felt like a glass of wine right now, and the sun was still high in the sky. Lately, she'd been drinking. Maybe not excessively, but certainly more enthusiastically than usual. She was on that slippery slope, hurtling towards drug and alcohol addiction. exciting to know she could still change in significant ways. Back home, there was a half-empty bottle of Pinot Noir sitting brazenly on her writing desk for anyone, only the cleaning lady, to see. She was Ernest frigging Hemingway. Didn't he have a bad back too? They had so much in common. Except that Frances had a weakness for adjectives and adverbs. Apparently, she scattered them about her novels like throw cushions. What was that Mark Twain quote Sol used to murmur to himself, just loud enough for her to hear while reading her manuscripts? When you catch an adjective, kill it. Sol was a real man who didn't like adjectives or throw cushions. She had an image of Sol in bed on top of her, swearing comically as he pulled out yet another cushion from behind her head, chucking it across the room while she giggled. She shook her head as if to shake off the memory. Fond sexual memories felt like a point for her first husband. When everything was good in Frances's life, she wished both her ex-husbands nothing but happiness and excellent erectile function. Right now, she wished plagues of locusts to rain down upon their silvery heads. She sucked on the tiny, vicious paper cut on the tip of her right thumb. Every now and then it throbbed to remind her that it might be the smallest of her ailments, but it could still ruin her day. Her car veered to the bumpy side of the road, and she removed her thumb from her mouth and clung to the steering wheel. Whoops-a-daisy! She had quite short legs, so she had to move the driver's seat close to the steering wheel. Henry used to say she looked like she was driving a dodgem car. He said it was cute. But after 5 years or so, he stopped finding it cute and swore every time he got in the car and had to slide the seat back. She found his sleep-talking charming for about 5 years or so, too. Focus! The countryside flew by. At last, a sign. Welcome to the town of Jarrabong. We're proud to be a tidy town. She slowed down to the speed limit of 50, which felt almost absurdly slow. Her head swiveled from side to side as she studied the town. A Chinese restaurant with a faded red and gold dragon on the door. A service station that looked closed. A red brick post office. A drive-through bottle shop that looked open. A police station that seemed entirely unnecessary. Not a person in sight. It might have been tidy, but it felt post-apocalyptic. She thought of her latest manuscript. It was set in a small town. This was the gritty, bleak reality of small towns. Not the charming village she'd created, nestled in the mountains, with a warm, bustling cafe that smelled of cinnamon, and, most fanciful of all, a bookstore, supposedly making a profit. The reviewers would rightly call it twee, but it probably wouldn't get reviewed, and she never read her reviews anyway. So that was it for poor old Jarrabong. Goodbye, sad little tidy town. She put her foot on the accelerator and watched her speed slide back up to 100. The website had said that the turnoff was 20 minutes outside of Jarrabong. There was a sign ahead. She narrowed her eyes, hunched over the wheel to read it. Tranquillum House, next turn on the left. Her heart lifted. She'd done it. She'd driven 6 hours without quite losing her mind. Then her heart sank, because now she was going to have to go through with this thing. Turn left,
In 1 kilometer, ordered her GPS. I don't want to turn left in 1 kilometer, said Frances dolefully. She wasn't even meant to be here in this season or hemisphere. She was meant to be with her special friend, Paul Drabble, in Santa Barbara. The Californian winter sun warm upon their faces as they visited wineries, restaurants, and museums. She was meant to be spending long, lingering afternoons getting to know Paul's 12-year-old son, Ari, hearing his dry little chuckle as he taught her how to play some violent PlayStation game he loved. Frances's friends with kids had laughed and scoffed over that, but she'd been looking forward to learning the game. The storyline sounded really quite rich and complex. An image came to her of that detective's earnest young face. He had freckles left over from childhood, and he wrote down everything she said in laborious longhand, using a scratchy blue ballpoint. His spelling was atrocious. He spelled tomorrow with 2 M's. He couldn't meet her eye. A sudden rush of intense heat enveloped her body at the memory. Humiliation? Probably. Her head swam. She shivered and shook. Her hands were instantly slippery on the steering wheel. Pull over, she told herself. You need to pull over right now. She indicated, even though there was no one behind her, and came to a stop on the side of the road. She had the sense to switch on her hazard lights. Sweat poured from her face. Within seconds, her shirt was drenched. She pulled at the fabric and smeared back strands of wet hair from her forehead. A cold chill made her shake. She sneezed, and the act of sneezing caused her back to spasm. The pain was of such truly biblical proportions that she began to laugh as tears streamed down her face. Oh, yes, she was losing her mind. She certainly was. A great wave of unfocused primal rage swept over her. She banged her fist against her car horn over and over, closed her eyes, threw back her head, and screamed in unison with the horn because she had this cold and this back pain and this broken bloody heart and, hey! She opened her eyes and jumped back in her seat. A man crouched next to her car window, rapping hard on the glass. She saw what must be his car pulled up on the opposite side of the road with its hazard lights also on. You okay? He shouted. Do you need help? For God's sake! This was meant to be a private moment of despair. How deeply embarrassing. She pressed the button to lower the window. A very large, unpleasant, unkempt, unshaven man peered in at her. He wore a T-shirt with the faded emblem of some ancient band over a proud, solid beer belly and low-slung blue jeans. He was probably one of those outback serial killers, even though this wasn't technically the outback. He was probably on holiday from the outback. Got car trouble? He asked. No, said Frances. She sat up straighter and tried to smile. She ran a hand through her damp hair. Thank you. I'm fine. The car is fine. Everything is fine. Are you sick? Said the man. He looked faintly disgusted. No, said Frances, not really. Just a bad cold. Maybe you've got the proper flu. You look really sick,
said the man. He frowned, and his eyes moved to the back of her car. And you were screaming and sounding your horn like you were in trouble.
Yes, said Francis. Well, I thought I was alone in the middle of nowhere. I was just having a bad moment.
She tried to keep the resentment from her voice. He was a good citizen who had done the right thing. He'd done what anyone would do.
Thank you for stopping, but I'm fine, she said nicely, with her sweetest, most placatory smile. One must placate large, strange men in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, then. The man straightened with a groan of effort, his hands on his thighs to give himself leverage, but then he rapped the top of her car with his knuckles and bent down again, suddenly decisive. I'm a man. I know what's what. Look, are you too sick to drive? Because if you're not safe to drive, if you're a danger to other drivers on the road, I really can't in good conscience let you...
Francis sat up straight. For heaven's sake.
I just had a hot flash, she snapped. The man blanched.
Oh.
He studied her, paused.
I always thought it was a hot flush, he said.
I believe both terms are used, said Francis. This was her third one. She'd done a lot of reading, spoken to every woman she knew over the age of 45, and had a double appointment with her GP where she had cried, "But no one ever said it was like this." For now, they were monitoring things. She was taking supplements, cutting back on alcohol and spicy foods.
Ha ha. So, you're okay?
Said the man. He looked up and down the highway as if for help. I really am perfectly fine, said Frances. Her back gave a friendly little spasm, and she tried not to flinch.
I didn't realize that hot flushes were so dramatic.
Well, they're not for everyone, just a lucky few.
Isn't there, what's it called? Hormone replacement therapy?
Oh, my Lord. Can you prescribe me something? Asked Francis, brightly. The man took a little step back from the car, hands up in surrender.
Sorry. It's just, I think that was what my wife... Anyway, none of my business... If everything is okay, I'll just be on my way.
Great, said Francis. Thank you for stopping.
No worries.
He lifted a hand, went to say something else, evidently changed his mind, and walked back towards his car. There were sweat marks on the back of his T-shirt. A mountain of a man. Lucky he decided she wasn't worth killing and raping. He probably preferred his victims less sweaty. She watched him start his car and pull out onto the highway. He tipped one finger to his forehead as he drove off. She waited until his car was a tiny speck in her rearview mirror, and then she reached over for the change of clothes she had waiting on the passenger seat, ready for this exact situation.
Menopause,
her 80-year-old mother had said vaguely on the phone from the other side of the world, where she now lived blissfully in the south of France.
Oh, I don't think it gave me too much trouble, darling. I got it all over and done within a weekend, as I recall. I'm sure you'll be the same. I never had those hot flushes. I think they're a myth, to be honest. Humph, thought Frances, as she used a towel to wipe away her mythical sweat. She thought of texting a photo of her tomato red face to her group of school friends, some of whom she'd known since kindergarten. Now, when they went out to dinner, they discussed menopause symptoms with the same avid horror with which they'd once discussed their first periods. Nobody else was getting these over-the-top hot flushes like Frances, so she was taking it for the team. Like everything in life, their reactions to menopause were driven by their personalities. Di said she was in a permanent state of rage, and if her gynecologist didn't agree to a hysterectomy soon, she was going to grab the little fucker by the collar and slam him up against the wall. Monica was embracing the beautiful intensity of her emotions, and Natalie was wondering anxiously if it was contributing to her anxiety. They all agreed it was totally typical of their friend Jillian to die so she could get out of menopause, and then they cried into their Prosecco. No, she wouldn't text her school friends, because she suddenly remembered how at that last dinner she'd looked up from her menu to catch an exchange of glances that most definitely meant, poor Frances. She could not bear pity. That particular group of solidly married friends was meant to envy her. Or they'd pretended to envy her, anyway, for all these years. But it seemed that being childless and single in your 30s was very different from being childless and single in your 50s. No longer glamorous. Now kind of tragic. I'm only temporarily tragic, she told herself as she pulled on a clean blouse that showed a lot of cleavage. She tossed the sweaty shirt into the back seat, restarted the car, looked over her shoulder, and pulled out onto the highway. Temporarily tragic. It could be the name of a band. There was a sign. She squinted. Tranquillum House, it said. Left turn ahead, said her GPS. Yes, I know. I see it. She met her own eyes in the rearview mirror and tried to give herself a wry, isn't life interesting look. Frances had always enjoyed the idea of parallel universes in which multiple versions of herself tried out different lives. One where she was a CEO instead of an author. One where she was a mother of two, or four, or six kids instead of none. One where she hadn't divorced Sol, and one where she hadn't divorced Henry. But for the most part, she'd always felt satisfied, or at least accepting of the universe in which she found herself. Except for right now. Because right now, it felt like there had been some sort of cataclysmic quantum physics administrative error. She'd slipped universes. She was meant to be high on lust and love in America, not pain-ridden and grief-stricken in Australia. It was just wrong, unacceptable. And yet here she was. There was nothing else to do, nowhere else to turn. God damn it, she said, and turned left. Chapter 3. Lars. This one is my wife's favourite. The vineyard manager, a chunky, cheery guy in his 60s with a retro moustache, held up a bottle of white wine. She says it makes her think of silk sheets. It has a creamy, velvety finish. I think you'll enjoy. Lars swirled the tasting glass and breathed in the scent. apples and sunshine and wood smoke. An instant memory of an autumnal day. The comfort of a large warm hand holding his. It felt like a childhood memory, but probably wasn't. More likely, a memory he'd borrowed from a book or movie. He sipped the wine, let it roll around his mouth, and was transported to a bar on the Amalfi Coast. Vine leaves over the light fitting, and the smell of garlic and the sea. That was a bona fide happy memory from real life, with photos to prove it. He remembered the spaghetti. Just parsley, olive oil, and almonds. There might even be a photo of the spaghetti somewhere. What do you think? The vineyard manager grinned. It was like his moustache had been perfectly preserved from 1975. It's excellent. Lars took another sip, trying to get the full picture. Wine could fool you, all sunshine and apples and spaghetti, and then nothing but sour disappointment and empty promises. I also have a Pinot Grigio that might appeal. Lars held up his hand and looked at his watch. I'd better stop there. Have you got far to travel today? Anyone who stopped here would be on their way to somewhere else. Lars had nearly missed the small wooden tasting cellar sign. He'd slammed on the brakes, because that's the sort of man he was. Spontaneous. When he remembered to be. I'm due to check in at a health resort in an hour's time. Lars held the wine glass up to the light and admired the golden colour. So no alcohol for me for the next 10 days. Ah, Tranquillum House, right? Said the manager. Doing the, what do they call it? 10-day cleanse or some such thing? For my sins, said Lars. We normally get guests stopping in here on their way home. We're the first vineyard they drive by on the road back to Sydney. What do they have to say about the place? Asked Lars. He pulled out his wallet. He was going to order some wine to be delivered as a welcome home treat. Some of them seem a bit shell-shocked, to be honest. They mostly just need a drink and some potato chips, and they get the colour back in their cheeks. The manager placed his hand around the neck of the bottle as if for comfort. Actually, my sister just got a job working in the spa there. She says her new boss is a bit... He squinted hard as if trying to see the word he wanted. Finally, he said, different. I'm forewarned, said Lars. He wasn't concerned. He was a health retreat junkie. The people who ran these places tended to be different. She says the house itself is amazing. It's got a fascinating history. Built by convicts, I believe. Lars tapped the corner of his gold Amex against the bar. Yeah, poor buggers. No spa treatments for them. A woman appeared from a door behind him, muttering, "Bloody internet is down again." She stopped when she saw Lars and did a double take. He was used to it. He'd had a lifetime of double takes. She looked away fast, flustered. This is my wife, said the vineyard manager with pride. We were just talking about your favourite Semillon, love. The silk sheet Semillon. The colour rose up her neck, I wish you wouldn't tell people that. Her husband looked confused. I always tell people that. I'm going to get a case, said Lars. He watched the wife pat her husband's back as she moved past him. Make it two cases, Lars said, because he spent his days dealing with the shattered remnants of broken marriages, and he was a sucker for a good one. He smiled at the woman. Her hands fluttered to her hair while her oblivious husband pulled out a battered old order book with a pen attached by a string, leaned heavily on the counter and peered at the form in a way that indicated this was going to take some time. Name? Lars Lee, said Lars, as his phone beeped with a text message. He tapped the screen. Can you at least think about it? Kiss, kiss. His heart lurched as if at the sudden scuttle of a black furry spider. For fuck's sake! He'd thought they were done with this. His thumb hovered over the message, considering. The passive aggressiveness of the at least. The saccharine double kiss. Also, he didn't like the fact that the first kiss was uppercase and the second was lowercase, and he didn't like the fact that he didn't like this. It was mildly OCD-ish. He tapped in a rude, boorish, uppercase reply. No, I will not. But then he deleted it and shoved his phone back into the pocket of his jeans. Let me try that Pinot Grigio. Chapter 4. Francis. Francis drove 20 minutes down a bumpy dirt road that jolted the car so hard her bones rattled and her lower back screamed. At last, she came to a stop in front of what appeared to be an extremely locked gate with an intercom. It was like arriving at a minimum security jail. An ugly barbed wire fence stretched endlessly in either direction. She had envisaged driving up a stately tree-lined drive to the historic house and having someone greet her with a green smoothie. This didn't feel very healing, to be frank. Stop it, she told herself. If she got into that I'm a dissatisfied consumer mode, everything would start to dissatisfy her, and she was going to be here for 10 days. She needed to be open and flexible. Going to a health resort was like traveling to a new country. One must embrace different cultures and be patient with minor inconveniences. She lowered her car window. Hot, thick air filled her throat like smoke as she leaned out and pressed the green button on the intercom with her thumb. The button burned from the sun, and it hurt her paper cut. She sucked on her thumb and waited for a disembodied voice to welcome her, or for the wrought iron gate to magically open. Nothing. She looked again at the intercom and saw a handwritten note sticky-taped next to the button. The writing was so small she could only make out the important word instructions, but nothing else. For goodness sake, she thought as she went through her handbag for her reading glasses. Surely a good proportion of visitors were over 40. She found her glasses, put them on, peered at the sign, and still couldn't make it out. Tut-tutting and muttering, she got out of the car. The heat grabbed her in a heavy embrace, and beads of sweat sprang up all over her scalp. She ducked down next to the intercom and read the note, written in neat, tiny block letters
as if by the tooth fairy. Namaste and welcome to Tranquillum House, where a new you awaits. Please press the security code 564-312, followed immediately by the green button. She pressed the security code numbers, then the green button, and waited. Sweat rolled down her back. She would need to change her clothes again. A blowfly buzzed near her mouth. Her nose dripped. "Oh, come on," she said to the intercom with a sudden spurt of rage, and she wondered if her agitated, sweaty face was appearing on some screen inside while an expert dispassionately analyzed her symptoms, her misaligned chakras. "This one needs work. Look at how she responds to one of life's simplest stresses. Waiting." Had she got the damned code wrong? Once again, she carefully punched in the security code, saying each number out loud, in a sarcastic tone, to prove a point to God knows who, and gave the hot green button a slow, deliberate push, holding it for 5 seconds, just to be sure. "There. Now let me in." She took off her reading glasses and let them dangle in her hand. The baking heat seemed to be melting her scalp like chocolate in the sun. "Silence again." She gave the intercom a fierce, hard look, as if that would shame it into acting. At least this would make a funny story for Paul. She wondered if he'd ever been to a health resort. She thought he'd most likely be a skeptic. She herself was... Her chest constricted. This wouldn't make a good story for Paul. Paul was gone. How humiliating for him to have slipped into her thoughts like that. She wished she felt a surge of white-hot anger instead of this utter sadness. This pretend grief for what had never been real in the first place. "Stop it. Don't think about it. Focus on the problem at hand." The solution was obvious. She would ring Tranquillum House. They would be mortified to hear that their intercom had broken, and Francis would be calm and understanding and brush away their apologies. "These things happen," she'd say. "Namaste." She got back in the car, cranked up the air conditioner. She found the paperwork with her booking details and rang the number listed. All her other communications had been by email, so it was the first time she'd heard the recorded message that immediately began to play. "Thank you for calling the historic Tranquillum House Health and Wellness Hot Springs Resort, where a new you awaits. Your call is so important and special to us, as is your health and well-being, but we are experiencing an unusually high volume of calls at the moment. We know your time is precious, so please do leave a message after the chimes, and we will call you back just as soon as we can. We so appreciate your patience. Namaste." Frances cleared her throat as wind chimes made their annoying, twinkly, dinging sounds. "Oh, yes, my name is..." The wind chimes kept going. She stopped, waited, went to speak, and stopped again. It was a wind chime symphony. At last, there was silence. "Hello, this is Frances Welty," she sniffed. "Excuse me, bit of a cold. Anyway, as I said, I'm Frances Welty. I'm a guest." "Guest?" Was that the right word? Patient. Inmate. I'm trying to check in, and I'm stuck outside the gate. It's 25 past three, and I'm here. The intercom doesn't seem to be working, even though I followed all the instructions. The teeny tiny instructions. I'd appreciate it if you could just open the gate. Let me in. Her message finished on a rising note of hysteria, which she regretted. She put the phone down on the seat next to her and studied the gate. Nothing. She would give it 20 minutes and then she was throwing in the towel. Her phone rang and she snatched it up without looking at the screen. "Hi there," she said cheerfully, to show how understanding and patient she really was, and to make up for the sarcastic teeny-tiny comment. "Francis?" It was Alain, her literary agent. "You don't sound like you." Francis sighed. "I was expecting someone else. I'm doing that health retreat I told you about, but I can't even get through the front gate. Their intercom isn't working." "How incompetent! How unsatisfactory!" Alain was easily and often enraged by poor service. "You should turn around and come back home. It's not alternative, is it? Remember those poor people who died in that sweat lodge? They all thought they were becoming enlightened, when in reality they were being cooked. This place is pretty mainstream. Hot springs and massages and art therapy. Maybe some gentle fasting." "Gentle fasting?" Alain snorted. "Eat when you're hungry. That's a privilege, you know, to eat when you're hungry, when there are people starving in this world." "Well, that's the point. We're not starving in this part of the world," said Frances. She looked at the wrapper for the Kit Kat bar sitting in the console of her car. "We're eating too much processed food, so that's why us privileged people need to detox." "Oh, my Lord. She's falling for it. She's drunk the Kool-Aid." "Detoxing is a myth, darling. It's been debunked. Your liver does it for you. Or maybe it's your kidneys. It's all taken care of somehow." "Anyway," said Francis. She had a feeling he was procrastinating. "Anyway," said Alain. "You sound like you've got a cold, Francis." He seemed quite anguished about her cold. "I do have a very bad, persistent, possibly permanent cold," said Francis. She coughed to demonstrate. "You'd be proud of me. I've been taking a lot of very powerful drugs. My heart is going at 1,000,000 miles per hour. "That's the ticket," said Alain. There was a pause. "Alain?" she prompted. But she knew. She already knew exactly what he was going to say. "I'm afraid I am not the bearer of good news," said Alain. "I see." She sucked in her stomach, ready to take it like a man, or at least like a romance novelist capable of reading her own royalty statements. "Well, as you know, darling," began Alain. But Francis couldn't bear to hear him hedging, trying to soften the blow with compliments. "They don't want the new book, do they?" she said. "They don't want the new book," said Alain sadly. "I'm so sorry. I think it's a beautiful book, I really do. It's just the current environment, and romance has taken the worst hit. That won't be forever. Romance always comes back. It's a blip, but So you'll sell it to someone else? Interrupted Francis. Sell it to Timmy. There was another pause.
The thing is, said Alain, I didn't tell you this, but I slipped the manuscript to Timmy a few weeks back because I did have a tiny fear this might happen. And obviously an offer from Timmy before we had anything on the table would have given me leverage. So I...
Timmy passed?
Frances couldn't believe it. Hanging in her wardrobe was a designer dress that she'd never be able to wear again because of the stain from a pina colada Timmy had spilled on her while he had her cornered in a room at the Melbourne Writers' Festival, his voice hasty and hot in her ear, looking back over his shoulder like a spy, telling her how much he wanted to publish her, how it was his destiny to publish her, how no one else in the publishing industry knew how to publish her the way he did, how her loyalty to Joe was admirable but misplaced, because Joe thought she understood romance, but she didn't. Only Timmy did, and only Timmy could and would take Frances to the next level. And so on and so forth, until Joe turned up and rescued her. Oi, leave my author alone. How long ago was that? Not that long, surely. Maybe 9, 10 years ago? A decade. Time went so fast these days. There was some sort of malfunction going on with how fast the earth was spinning. Decades went by as quickly as years once did.
Timmy loved the book, said Alain. Adored it. He was nearly in tears. He couldn't get it past acquisitions. They're all shaking in their boots over there. It was a hell of a year. The decree from above is psychological thrillers.
I can't write a thriller, said Frances. She never liked to kill characters. Sometimes she let them break a limb, but she felt bad enough about that.
Of course you can't, said Alain too quickly,
and Frances felt mildly insulted.
Look, I have to admit I was worried when Joe left and you were out of contract, said Alain. But Ashley seemed to really be a fan of yours.
Frances's concentration drifted as Alain continued to talk. She watched the closed gate and pushed the knuckles of her left hand into her lower back. What would Joe say when she heard Frances had been rejected? Or would she have had to do the same thing? Frances had always assumed that Joe would be her editor forever. She had fondly imagined them finishing their working lives simultaneously, perhaps with a lavish joint retirement lunch. But late last year, Joe had announced her intention to retire. Retire? Like she was some sort of old grandma. Joe actually was a grandmother, but for goodness sake, that wasn't a reason to stop. Frances felt like she was only just getting into the swing of things, and all of a sudden people in her circle were doing old people things. Having grandchildren, retiring, downsizing, dying. Not in car accidents or plane crashes. No, dying peacefully in their sleep. She would never forgive Gillian for that. Gillian always slipped out of parties without saying goodbye. It shouldn't have come as a surprise when Joe's replacement turned out to be a child, because children were taking over the world. Everywhere Frances looked, there were children. Children sitting gravely behind news desks, controlling traffic, running writers' festivals, taking her blood pressure, managing her taxes, and fitting her bras. When Frances first met Ashley, she had genuinely thought she was there on work experience. She'd been about to say,
A cappuccino would be lovely, darling. When the child had walked around to the other side of Joe's old desk. Frances, she'd said, this is such a fangirl moment for me. I used to read your books when I was like 11. I stole them from my mum's handbag. I'd be like, Mum, you've got to let me read Nathaniel's Kiss. And she'd be like, no way, Ashley. There's too much sex in it. Then Ashley had proceeded to tell Frances that her next book needed more sex. A lot more sex. But she knew Frances could totally pull it off. As Ashley was sure Frances knew, the market was changing and... If you just look at this chart here, Frances... No, here, that's it. You'll see that your sales have been on kind of a... Well, sorry to say this, but you kind of have to call this a downward trend. And we, like, really need to reverse that. Like... super fast. Oh, and one other thing. Ashley looked pained, as if she were about to bring up an embarrassing medical issue. Your social media presence? I hear you're not so keen on social media. Neither is my mum, but it's kind of essential in today's market. Your fans really do need to see you on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. That's just the bare minimum. Also, we'd love you to start a blog and a newsletter and perhaps do some regular vlogs. That'd be so much fun. They're like little films. I have a website, replied Frances. Yes, said Ashley kindly. Yes, you do, Frances. But nobody cares about websites. And then she'd angled her computer monitor towards Frances so she could show her some examples of other better behaved authors with active social media presences. And Frances had stopped listening and waited for it to be over, like a dental appointment. She couldn't see the screen anyway. She didn't have her glasses with her. But she wasn't worried, because she was falling in love with Paul Drabble at the time, and when she was falling in love, she always wrote her best books. And besides, she had the sweetest, most loyal readers in the world. Her sales might drop, but she would always be published. I will find the right home for this book, said Alain now. It might just take a little while. Romance isn't dead. Isn't it? Said Frances. Not even close, said Alain. She picked up the empty Kit Kat wrapper and licked it, hoping for fragments of chocolate. How was she going to get through this setback without sugar? Frances, said Alain. My back hurts a great deal, said Frances. She blew her nose hard. Also, I had to stop the car in the middle of the road to have a hot flush. That sounds truly awful, said Alain with feeling. I can't even imagine. No, you can't. A man stopped to see if I was all right because I was screaming. You were screaming? Said Alain. I felt like screaming, said Frances. Of course, said Alain hurriedly. I understand. I often feel like screaming. This was rock bottom. She'd just licked a Kit Kat wrapper. Oh, dear, Frances, I'm so sorry about this, especially after what happened with that horrendous man. Have the police had anything new to say? No, said Frances. No news. Darling, I'm just bleeding for you here.
That's not necessary, sniffed Frances. You've just had such a bad trot lately, darling. Speaking of which, I want you to know that review had absolutely no impact on their decision. What review? Said Frances. There was silence. She knew Alain was smacking his forehead. Alain? Oh, God, he said. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. I haven't read a review since 1998, said Frances. Not a single review. You know that? I absolutely know that, said Alain. I'm an idiot. I'm a fool. Why would there be a review when I don't have a new book out? Frances wriggled upright in her seat. Her back hurt so much, she thought she might be sick. Some bitch picked up a copy of What the Heart Wants at the airport and did an opinion piece about, your books in general. A mad diatribe. She kind of linked it to the Me Too movement, which gave it some clickbait traction. It was just ridiculous, as if romance books are to blame for sexual predators. What? Nobody even read the review. I don't know why I mentioned it. I must have early onset dementia. You just said it got traction. Everyone had read the review. Everyone. Send me the link, said Frances. It's not even that bad, said Alain. It's just this prejudice against your genre. Send it. No, said Alain. I won't. You've gone all these years without reading reviews. Don't fall off the wagon. Right now, said Frances in her dangerous voice. She used it rarely. When she was getting divorced, for example. I'll send it, said Alain meekly. I'm so sorry, Frances. I'm so sorry about this entire phone call. He hung up, and Frances immediately went to her email. There wasn't much time. As soon as she arrived at Tranquillum House, she would need to hand in her device. It would be a digital detox along with everything else. She was going off the grid. So sorry, said Alain's email. She clicked on the review. It was written by someone called Helen Einat. Frances didn't know the name, and there was no picture. She read it fast, with a wry, dignified smile, as if the author was saying these things to her face. It was a terrible review. Vicious, sarcastic, and superior. But, interestingly, it didn't hurt. The words formulaic, trash, drivel, trite slid right off her. She was fine. Can't please everyone. Comes with the territory. And then she felt it. It was like when you burn yourself on a hot plate, and at first you think, ha, that should have hurt more. And then it does hurt more. And then all of a sudden, it hurts like hell. A quite extraordinary pain in her chest radiated throughout her entire body. Another fun symptom of menopause? Maybe it was a heart attack. Women had heart attacks. Surely this was more than hurt feelings. This, of course, was why she'd given up reading reviews in the first place. Her skin was too thin. It was the best decision I ever made, she'd told the audience at the Romance Writers of Australia conference when she gave the keynote address last year. They'd probably all been thinking, yeah, maybe you should read a review or two, Frances, you old has-been.
Why did she think it was a good idea to read a bad review directly after she just received her first rejection in 30 years? And now, something else was happening. It appeared, and gosh, this was just so fascinating, but it seemed she was losing her entire sense of self. Come on now, Frances, get a grip. You're too old for an existential crisis. But apparently she wasn't. She scrabbled hopelessly after her self-identity, but it was like trying to catch water rushing down a drain. If she was no longer a published writer, who was she? What was the actual point of her? She wasn't a mother or a wife or a girlfriend. She was a twice-divorced, middle-aged, hot-flushing-slash-flashing menopausal woman. A punchline. A cliché. Invisible to most. Except, of course, to men like Paul Drabble. She looked at the gate in front of her that still would not open, and her vision blurred with tears, and she told herself not to panic. You are not disappearing, Frances. Don't be so melodramatic. This is just a rough trot, a bad patch, and it's the cold and flu tablets making your heart race. But it felt like she was hovering on a precipice, and on the other side of the precipice was a howling abyss of despair, unlike anything she'd ever experienced, even during those times of true grief. And this is not true grief, she reminded herself. This is a career setback combined with the loss of a relationship, a bad back, a cold, and a paper cut. This is not like when Dad died, or Gillian died. But actually, it wasn't that helpful to start remembering the deaths of loved ones. Not helpful at all. She looked around wildly for distraction. Her phone, her book, food. And then she saw movement in her rearview mirror. What was it? An animal? A trick of the light? No, it was something. It was too slow for a car. Wait, it was a car. It was just driving so slowly, it was barely moving. She sat up straight and ran her fingers under her eyes where her mascara had run. A canary yellow sports car drove down the dirt drive slower than she would have thought possible. Frances had no interest in cars, but as it got closer, even she could tell this was a spectacularly expensive piece of machinery. Low to the ground and shimmery shiny with futuristic headlights. It came to a stop behind hers, and the doors on either side opened simultaneously. A young man and woman emerged. Frances adjusted her mirror to see them more clearly. The man looked like a suburban plumber off to a Sunday barbecue. Baseball cap on backwards, sunglasses, t-shirt, shorts, and boat shoes with no socks. The woman had amazing long curly auburn hair, skin-tight capri pants, an impossibly tiny waist, and even more unlikely breasts. She teetered on stilettos. Why in the world would a young couple like that come to a health retreat? Wasn't this sort of place for the overweight and burnt out? For those grappling with bad backs and pathetic midlife identity crises? As Frances watched, the man turned his baseball cap around the right way and tipped his head back, arching his back, as if he too found the sky overwhelming. The woman said something to him. Frances could tell by the way her mouth moved that it was sharp. They were arguing. How delightfully distracting. Frances lowered her window. These people would pull her back from the precipice, bring her back into existence. she would regain her self-identity by existing in their eyes. They would see her as old and eccentric and maybe even annoying, but it didn't matter how they saw her, as long as they saw her. She leaned clumsily out the car window, waggled her fingers and called out, "Hello!" The girl tottered over the grass towards her.